Cases 21-5734 USA versus Marchane Woods and 21-5742 USA versus Terry Woods. Argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Ms. Coffin, you may proceed for the appellant.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I am Jennifer Coffin. I'm here today on behalf of Marchane and Terry Woods. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time.
Thank you.
Thank you. The primary issue in this appeal is whether this court's en banc decision in Havis applies retroactively in a sentence reduction proceeding brought under Section 404 of the First Step Act.
Can you keep your voice up, or is there a microphone closer?
I will try to speak louder. Yes. Sorry about that. So I was saying that the primary issue in this appeal is whether this court's en banc decision in Havis applies retroactively in the context of a sentence reduction proceeding brought under Section 404 of the First Step Act. The Woods brothers' position is that Havis does so apply retroactively, at least in this specific context, and that therefore the district court made an inadvertent error in calculating their amended guideline range for purposes of the starting point from
which...
You're
arguing that's procedural error, correct?
Yes.
But isn't it true that under the First Step Act, Fair Sentencing Act combination, they only need to consider, and we've said it in Maxwell, we've said it in many places, only consider the crack powder portion of it and calculate that guideline correctly?
It is true that in Maxwell, this court said that the district court is not to include non-retroactive changes in the guideline calculation. And that was made clear in Jarvis, that Maxwell was speaking of non-retroactive changes when it said that those are not included in the guideline calculation.
So you lose if we find that Havis is non-retroactive, is what you're saying.
Under the Woods theory of the state of the law now, which is that all retroactive changes apply, which is clear in Jarvis and then again in Michael Johnson, then yes, I lose at least with respect to the guideline calculation error if the court says that Havis is not retroactive. But the Woods brothers have an alternative argument, which is that even under the 3553A analysis, the court should have considered this en banc decision.
But you're saying it should have considered it sua sponte. It's non-retroactive, right? And what Concepcion clearly says is unless it's squarely presented to them, this district court need not consider it.
So our argument is not that the district court should have sua sponte considered an argument that was not raised. Our argument is that in the Court of Appeals, now that it's clear that the court made such a mistake, and it's a very clear and obvious error, everybody made the mistake.
Wait, in the Court of Appeals?
Yes, here, in this court.
No, my question is the district court.
Right, the district court was not required to sua sponte to consider an argument not raised. That is very clear.
And it wasn't required to consider the change in career offender status at the 3553A stage as a matter of discretion, was it? It could have said, yeah, I hear your argument. Maybe they're not career offenders, but they're really bad guys, so I'm just not going to consider that.
That is true. Okay. But it had it been raised, the argument is that this court has discretion on plain error review to take into account the circumstances that were actually presented there, and that is the
circumstances,
yes.
But not the arguments.
Well, that's
because,
in deciding
because why did your, and I apparently it was not you personally, but your office said that they're career offenders.
That is true, but this was in the context of a big fight about eligibility, and I don't think that they were focusing on that. But what I would say is...
Wait, is that an excuse?
No, it is not an excuse. But I'm just trying to explain why it happened that this is my own office, actually.
That's why
our office is the office that handled Havis. So it was a true mistake made by everybody. But I would point to the court's decision in, say, Atkinson or in Jackson, where this particular decision did warrant remand even when it wasn't raised.
Well, because that is binding. And in Maxwell, we say exactly what Judge Boggs said, which is if it's presented, in that case, it was Eastern District of Kentucky, they just said, that's great, your guys are bad guys, I'm not considering it. You're saying we can't reverse on that because Maxwell says we can't. But if you don't bring it up at all, we can reverse?
So in the circumstances here, we don't know what the district court would have done. So this
Wait a minute. We're talking about abusive discretion. It's not an abusive discretion for the district court to say, I'm not going to consider it, even though I understand your argument is right because you're a bad guy. And it's not an abuse of discretion, but it is plain error. If no one brings it up, doesn't that invert the standards of review?
So I did anticipate this question.
Oh, good. That's because you're a good advocate. So.
And what I would say to that is that this is not the case where we know what the district court would have said had the district court been aware. This is instead a case where the district court was actually very careful to look at what the actual guideline range is under the amended guideline range is supposed to be. So the judge cared what that was supposed to be. He laid it out in both of their orders. And it does appear that the judge
The more careful a district judge is, the more we're going to punish him on appeal for not bringing up arguments sua sponte that everyone said. I mean, this just seems like we're throwing out standards of review altogether, because even under de novo review, you would say it would be absurd for us to sua sponte raise an argument.
So I would first take issue with the idea that the Court of Appeals is punishing the district court for making a mistake that everybody made. And I would point to, for example, Jackson, which is a really great example, because in that case, everybody missed Havis, the impact of Havis in that case, until even after a published decision came out, and the counsel for Mr. Combs filed a petition for panel rehearing, and the court immediately amended its decision.
Go ahead.
What you're talking about, is it Jackson?
Yes.
Yes, that's the one that just came out recently where we did remand.
Yes.
After the panel took that into account.
Yes.
Of course, the panel was correcting itself in a sense, not solely correcting the district court.
That's right. And I'd also like to...
Let me let you finish. I broke in.
Well, there's at least one other circuit, and I have not brought this case to the court's attention yet, but I will now. The Third Circuit recently addressed a situation where the parties did not bring up a decision that was the equivalent of Havis in that circuit. That's Nasir in the Third Circuit. That case is Shields. And in that case, the Third Circuit, though it did treat in that case Nasir as they sort of assumed it wasn't retroactive, there was no analysis, it did remand because the district court didn't have the opportunity to consider that major decision in its 3553A analysis. Yeah. So it's not out of the realm of possibility that when you're talking about something this...
Yeah, but we're talking about Article 3 is an adversarial process. And we aren't just roving commissions looking for errors, the Supreme Court has said. And so now what you're asking us to do is every case, if they bring it up, this is the anomaly that you're asking us to create, which is what really troubles me. If they bring it up in the district court and the district court rejects it, we affirm. If they don't bring it up, they argue, they get a reduction, then they can come to the Court of Appeals and say, yeah, but this one argument we didn't bring up, the district court should have considered.
Well, let's...
Not only did we not bring it up, we stipulated to the opposite.
So I'm going to also dispute the idea that there was a stipulation in this case. It was really just people saying that he was still a career offender because they didn't think about it.
No, they said it in writing, didn't they?
They did say it in writing, but I don't believe that that's the same thing as a stipulation.
Well, let me ask you something here, because it's not, perhaps not quite as clear as Judge... Thapar may have just put it, and I wanted to ask you what you thought the judge meant on page 5 of, I think it's page 5 of both brothers, where he says applying the 2018 guidelines manual, because it wasn't that he just didn't think about it. He said he was applying it, and your argument is that he's applying it wrongly, isn't it, when we're talking about at the 3553A stage, he sort of anchors it to the fact that they're career offenders. Your argument is that whether retroactive or not after Havis, they're not career offenders.
That's right, exactly.
So when the judge, I mean, again, maybe he got himself in trouble by saying more, but he did say, I'm applying the 2018 guidelines. Is that kind of your point?
It is. And one way to think about that is that the sentence was based on an inaccuracy. It was a mistake of fact. And so that you could think about that as procedural error, even in the 3553A analysis. The judge based his decision on a fact that was actually not accurate.
So now we're going to punish district courts for not saying, applying the 2018 guideline manuals, the defendant's guideline range is now 360 months to life, based on a career offender total offense level of 37 that the parties all agree to. Had he put that language in, it's different. But because he's just doing this, right, that's what you're saying.
Is there something in Montgomery and Howard that addresses this issue?
Well, I would say that Montgomery is about, tells us that when the party or when the defendant invites an error, then we do a plain error analysis plus an additional level of discretionary analysis. So, Montgomery is very relevant to this case because it talks about what an invited error is. And I think the kinds of statement that was made by counsel in this case is very similar to the statement that was made in Montgomery, which was just an accidental statement about what the guideline range was.
How can it be plain? There, it was plain or obvious because it was the criminal history category that was obviously wrong. Here, you're saying, and you say at page one of your brief, this case presents an important question of whether Havis is retroactive. That is the basis. And you started your argument with that. How can it be plain or obvious if it presents an important question that this court hasn't yet decided?
Well, the issue is whether Havis applies retroactively in the First Step Act context in Section 404 proceedings.
And you agree that hasn't been, point me what decision of this court says it does. You say in your brief no one's decided it. You said at the beginning of argument. So how can it be plain or obvious if it's never been said before?
Ah, that's a good question. So at the district court, at the time that the court was deciding this case, it was understood that Boulding says that you're supposed to look at the actual amended guideline range under current law. So the judge was actually doing what everyone thought Boulding said they were supposed to do, which is to calculate the guideline range under current law. So there wasn't the question whether Havis was retroactive and it needed to be part of the amended guideline range didn't come up. It wasn't an issue. And in fact, in Maxwell, one of the defendant in Maxwell made two arguments why he wasn't a career offender anymore. And one was because of Havis, and the second one was because of the deletion of the residual clause. The government, in its responsive brief, under the idea that Boulding says that the amended guideline range today is what you look at, agreed that under Havis, Mr. Maxwell was not a career offender anymore. So that's why it came out the way it did. That's why at the time that this was...
We said in Maxwell, the district court could completely disregard that.
Well, actually, the court in Maxwell just said that non-retroactive changes are not part of the amended guideline range. They are to be considered as part of the 3553A analysis.
Right, but
then... Isn't that an important distinction here? Because retroactivity may be very significant if you're talking about making the benchmark guidelines decision. But it's a different matter if you're saying that this concept is applicable in the 3553 context, isn't it?
That's right. And we didn't know.
But wait a minute.
That retroactivity matters.
It's the inverse of what Judge Strand just said, because Maxwell covers the latter, not the former.
But Concepcion is how we learned that retroactivity matters. So that's why it only comes up now that we have to care whether Havis...
Concepcion says the argument has to be presented to the district court. Here's the language.
Not if it's a retroactive guideline amendment. It says that the calculation of the guideline range is the one thing that matters the most, and it does not say that plain error review does not apply to that.
All that is required, and this is in the 3553A area, for a district court to demonstrate that it's considered the arguments before it.
That's true, but that's when you're in the 3553A part.
Right, that's my
point.
When
you're in the guideline calculation part, only now do we know that it matters whether it's retroactive.
So that's my point, is it's actually inverse, because it only matters in the procedural reasonableness. In the 3553, the argument under Concepcion has to be presented to the court.
If it's not presented to the court, then on review, you're looking at plain error review, and the question whether a non-presented, well, Concepcion does not say anything about what the review would be if it's not raised in the Court of Appeals.
No, but it says the district court never abuses their discretion if the argument's not presented to it.
Well, I would say that's reading a lot into Concepcion that would take away the kinds of plain error review that ordinarily exists. I don't read Concepcion as removing plain error review even in the 3553A context. It does say it's not supposed to be overly searching. I see that. But with Havis, which is, took an instant...
Aren't you asking us to be overly searching?
It takes 1 second to see a conspiracy conviction and a career offender guideline to know that Havis says the person...
And your office is the pros and they didn't see it.
It's true. It was a mistake. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Sam Fitzpatrick and I represent the United States. The district court did not plainly err when it granted the defendant's motions for sentence reductions under the First Step Act. When the court granted those motions, it issued 2 8-page orders. And those orders show that the court followed the procedures that are required under the First Step Act. First, the district court accurately calculated the defendant's amended guidelines range. Concepcion instructs exactly how district courts are supposed to calculate that amended guidelines range. And according to the Supreme Court in Concepcion, district courts cannot recalculate a move-in's benchmark guidelines range in any way other than to reflect the retroactive application of the Fair Sentencing Act.
So that except for that retroactive application, they should have been applying the 2001 or whatever guidelines, is that right?
Yes, Your Honor, I think so.
All right, so then you were right with me in focusing on the order. I've got Terry Woods's, but they're essentially identical. When the judge says at page 5, applying the 2018 guidelines manual, and then he starts talking about the career offender level and so on, what do you think he meant or what he... How should we take what he meant when he says he's applying the 2018 guidelines manual, which then would bring up Havis?
Yes, Your Honor.
What did you think he meant there at page 5?
My understanding of what the district court means there is that the district court is applying retroactively amendments 782 and 788. Those were the amendments that were promulgated after the Fair Sentencing Act that reduced offense levels in the implementation of the Fair Sentencing Act. And this court held in Johnson that district courts are supposed to retroactively apply those two amendments, Amendment 782.
I think I'm with you there.
Yes, Your Honor.
But since he then went on where he's clearly, talking about the 3553A factors, to talk about the career offender in a way that isn't correct after Havis. Do you agree with that if we just focus on that narrowly, that if he says, I'm applying the 2018 guidelines and the law now, that's wrong because of Havis with respect to career offender status?
No, Your Honor, I don't think so, and here's why. The district court, this court determined in Maxwell, the issue in Maxwell was whether or not the defendants changed status as a career offender was something that the district court was required to consider when it calculated the defendant's amended guidelines range. And the court in Maxwell was absolutely clear on this point that it was not. And so I think that this court has clearly and emphatically held that a change in the defendant's career offender status is not only is it not permitted, but that a district court is prohibited. And that aligns perfectly.
District court is prohibited? So if at this point, if the judge had said, now I'm thinking about the 2018 guidelines, and I've read Havis, which has already come out, and because of this, in my 3553A, I'm not going to consider you a career offender? He's prohibited from doing that?
No, Your Honor. Let me clarify. Okay. A district court is prohibited from calculating the amended guidelines.
Okay, well, but I said I'm at least at this point, I at least am agreeing with you as opposed to your adversary about the guidelines calculation. Now I'm talking about the 3553A factors. And the reason I sort of say that is I get to the question on page 7 where the judge is getting down to the end of this, and he says, having considered it, we conclude that the defendant's career offender designation, which he's obviously taking into account, leads to a sentence which is slightly greater than necessary. And the kind of question here is, if at that point, again, if the other side said, wait a minute, he's not a career offender, Your Honor, we think it's not just slightly greater than necessary, it's a lot greater than necessary. What would the judge have done at that point? What should he have done? He should have considered it, shouldn't he?
Absolutely. And
all right. But now he didn't consider it. He didn't consider the fact that he's not a career offender.
Well, I think Concepcion answers this question, Your Honor. Concepcion addressed whether a district court must, may, or may not consider intervening changes in law when it's addressing a motion under the First Step Act. And the Supreme Court's decision touched on all three of those imperatives. And according to the Supreme Court, district courts must consider intervening changes when parties raise them. The Supreme Court went on to say that district courts may consider intervening changes in their discretion even when parties do not raise them. And so I think that would answer your question, Judge Boggs, of whether or not the district court, in its discretion, it could have considered that if the parties had raised...
And the part you're quoting of Concepcion is dealing with the 3553A stage, not the guideline calculation stage?
Yes, Your Honor. The part that district courts must consider intervening changes when parties raise them.
That's at the 3553A stage.
Yes, Your Honor.
I want to make sure that we're on the same page of that. Okay. And so the question really, at least to me, is that part, they may consider it, they don't have to, but if they do consider it and consider it wrongly, what do we do? When it says I'm applying the 2018 guidelines as intervening changes with intervening decisions, and he gets it wrong, what do we do? Do we say close enough?
Well, Your Honor, I think it's important here to separate out the part of the district court's opinion that you're referencing. That's the part where the court is calculating the amended guidelines range.
Is it? I mean, by page 7, he's, in fact, the next thing he says is it's slightly greater than necessary. That those are 3553A kind of words. They're not guideline words, aren't they?
Let me step back, Your Honor. The part of the district court's decision where it calculates that the defendant's amended guidelines range is 360 to life, okay, where it references the 2018 guidelines, right, that's where the district court is calculating the defendant's amended guidelines range. Right. And I think that Concepcion and Maxwell are crystal clear that when the district court does that, it only alters one variable.
Okay, now I'm with you on all of that. So, in that sense, is your argument that my harping on page 5 and the 2018 guidelines range is we should just sort of draw a line a couple of paragraphs down and say, okay, he's finished with the 2018 guidelines. Now he's just doing general justice.
I think that's a fair reading of the district court's opinion, Your Honor.
And your point is he doesn't have to change the guidelines in the 3553A factors if the defendant doesn't ask, and that's Concepcion.
That's exactly right, Your Honor.
And then how do you account for Jackson's post-publication of an opinion that then turned around and made revisions to the opinion? Put out a new paragraph that seems to me to have some real effect on this case. Why doesn't it?
Well, Your Honor, I think the decision in Jackson, I think we have to go back to Concepcion on this point. And if the question is whether or not the district court was required to consider changes in the defendant's career offender status under Havis, I think Concepcion answers that clearly. And Concepcion says that when the district court calculates the amended guideline range, it cannot take things like, it cannot account for anything other than the retroactive application of the Fair Sentencing Act.
Yeah, but that's still back at the guidelines. Let me ask you this. Judge Stranch has appropriately brought up Jackson. There's a case a little bit later called Bass, which is a little bit different, but it specifically says that it's an abuse of discretion in a slightly different context in a 3553A when you rest upon errors of law. And to the extent, again, we have to read it this way, decide to read it, that if the judge says under the guidelines now you're still a career offender, isn't that an error of law?
I don't think so, Your Honor.
If you're familiar with Bass, there's no particular reason you should be, but it's pretty reasonable.
Yes, Your Honor, I've read the opinion. It's not very fresh in my mind, but I have read it. And I think that, to make sure I understand your question, I think you're asking it that if the district court relied on an error of law in the 3553A factors.
Right.
Okay. I think that this court just has to go to the standard of review. And, I mean, so two examples.
So you'd say if he makes an error of law in the 3553A factors, and that error of law is not presented to him and is in fact invited, then you just don't consider it.
Yes, Your Honor, and I think a good case that sort of highlights this principle at play is Alexander. This exact same scenario played out in Alexander, and in that case, the defendant moved for a sentence reduction. The defendant agreed that the district court should resentence him as a career offender, and the defendant asked for a sentence at the bottom of his career offender guideline range. And the district court did those things. And on appeal, the defendant argued that the district court erred because, in fact, it didn't understand that it could enter a sentence at below the bottom end of the career offender guideline. And this court rejected that argument and concluded that the district court did not err. Another case that I think is very similar to this one is Barber. And in Barber, the defendant also asked for, moved for a sentence reduction under the First Step Act, but didn't ask the district court to consider his post-sentencing conduct. The district court didn't consider his post-sentencing conduct, and on appeal, the defendant argued that the district court erred, that it should have considered his post-sentencing conduct. And this court also rejected that argument and held that it's no...
Yeah, I understand where you're headed on that, but I'm struggling a little bit to understand how that relates to Rosales-Morales, a Supreme Court case that was addressing error. What the questions that Judge Boggs has been asking you about, what this court did incorrectly. In Rosales, there was a defendant in a criminal history Category 6 instead of Category 5, placed in the wrong place, which is what happened here, held that it's the kind of error that seriously affects the fairness, integrity, or public reputation of judicial proceedings. And of course, that is in the in pursuit of the plain error analysis. But why doesn't that fit this situation here, the type of error that Judge Boggs has already asked you about and you've conceded was error? So why aren't we now in Supreme Court rule land in which we get to look at the plain error standard?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Straighten me out if I'm missing something, but I don't see how we don't have an error below that deserves the opportunity to be considered under the fairness, integrity, and public reputation of the judicial proceedings standard.
Well, I think that the difference is that in the cases cited by the defendants, if the district court makes an error in calculating the amended guidelines range.
No, I think that was the discussion you just had with Judge Boggs, in which he said, no, that is earlier in this opinion, and I'm talking about where the court turned to the 3553 factors and made these statements. Mm-hmm. So that's where we are.
Right, and I think that the cases where the court has found, has remanded and has found error, those were cases where the district court incorrectly calculated the amended guidelines range. And so I think that's a difference here, because I think the district court did correctly calculate the amended guidelines range.
Yeah, we all seem to be kind of with you on that. Just going back to the line that, I don't know, focuses or troubles me, where he says, the career offender designation leads to a sentence which is slightly greater than necessary. Does that not imply a bit that without the career offender guideline, he might have decided that it was a lot greater than necessary? I mean, again, you know, judges don't write law review articles on every opinion, thank God, but does it seem to you that his view of his amount, not that he's limited, but his amount of departure was related to their career offender status?
Certainly, but I don't think the district court erred when it mentioned the career offender status in the 3553A factors. And the reason is because I think the court is referring back to the amended guideline range, which is the correct range and which applies. And the court did base its decision on that correctly calculated range. It departed one level below the offense level of 37 for both defendants, and then it added an additional 18 months for Marshane Woods for his exceptional rehabilitative efforts. I can see that my time is up, Your Honors.
I just have one more kind of struggling question, and I know it's a step beyond where you were, and it is from Montgomery, but I'm just struggling with the interests of justice. To me, this is not about punishing a district court. It's about being sure that what the district court tried so hard to do correctly, in fact, was done correctly. And so if interest of justice, frankly, would the interests of justice be served here by requiring these defendants to remain in prison longer, because, as Montgomery said, no one in the district court, the court itself included, noticed that the career offender guidelines had changed or excluded conspiracy offenses. And it seems to me that that's part of the mix of things that we're looking at here. Why does that not matter to this case? Or why can we bar that from being considered in this case?
Well, Your Honor, I think that the decision in Concepcion shows that a remand in this case would replace Concepcion's grant of authority. It would replace that with a mandate. And I don't think that would be consistent with the Supreme Court's decision in Concepcion.
A mandate to do what?
A mandate to consider intervening changes in law. And I think Concepcion was crystal clear that district courts may, in their discretion, consider intervening changes in law, but district courts are not required to consider those as they would during a plenary sentencing.
So then there is suggestion to district courts just not to say anything about it. I mean, we're both struggling with silence in the record here, aren't we?
It certainly seems like it, Your Honor.
And so if the court chooses, instead of articulating clearly, some of us might say, well, that means that you're punishing them for articulating clearly. Well, then there's the other side of that. You are rewarding them if they just keep their mouth shut. Then it never comes back down to them. Right? Just not saying anything is license then not to have to reconsider something that you did not address, right?
You're saying that the district court.
I'm talking about the incentives of how we struggle with silence in a record, and I'm just trying to get your understanding of that.
Well, Your Honor, my understanding is that under the plain error standard of review, that a district court cannot have erred for not considering arguments that aren't presented to it.
Doesn't Concepcion answer this? It says we can't punish district courts for silence. They only have to answer the questions presented to them, especially in the 3553A stage, whereas Rosales, Morales,
and Montgomery, and all the cases in the procedural reasonableness area, I get it. The district court has to calculate the guidelines right, so that is an affirmative obligation on the district court to calculate the guidelines right. Here, there's no debate under your mind that the district court calculated the guidelines right. So now you get to the 3553, and the Supreme Court tells us, no matter what other courts say, the Supreme Court says, district court only has to address arguments presented to it. It's not an argument presented to it, so now we're going to fly spec their eight-page opinions. They're better off just writing one page, because it's less for us to fly spec. And so what we're actually encouraging by being a roving commission looking for error is that district courts do less, not more. Isn't that your answer?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that's exactly right. I think that a remand here would encourage, would create an incentive for district courts to say less.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So I'd like to first address Judge Boggs, your idea that there was a mistake made in the 3553A discussion that reasonably could, under my theory, warrant a remand so the judge could actually engage in that analysis without that mistake. There's a really rich vein of case law in this circuit and others that say that a sentence that's based on an erroneous assumption is an abuse of discretion. In fact, it's a due process error. And that's United States versus Adams is sort of the best.
So how does that interact with Judge Thapar's repeated statement from Concepcion that even at the 3553A stage, or especially at the 35, only has to consider issues presented?
Well, it says that the review, except for guideline calculation errors, is not supposed to be overly searching, and I would suggest
so
that
it's not really, it only has to consider them, it only has to consider them, but not in an overly...
This would not be overly searching to realize that this mistake was made.
What does this sentence mean? I'm quoting. It's the last sentence in the holding. All that is required for a district court to demonstrate that it has considered the arguments before it. Can we just ignore that? Should I white it out of the Supreme Court opinion?
No, that's the same standard that applies at original sentencing, really. It's required to consider the arguments presented. That doesn't tell us...
It says all that is required. And then Justice Sotomayor repeatedly says in Section B, when raised by the parties. Moreover, when raised by the parties, district courts have considered.
I am very aware of those passages, but I do not read them as removing from the Court of Appeals its discretionary authority to send things back under a plain error or invited error standard when the circumstances warrant it. I
guess the thing I'm struggling with is what I brought up earlier, maybe you have a better answer now, is aren't we turning abuse of discretion, we're making it, we're inverting plain error and abuse of discretion in the standard of review world. In other words, we're saying if you don't present it, we can reverse, but if you do present it and the district court says nothing about it, we can't reverse because of Maxwell.
If you do present it, and because of, I'm not sure I follow the Maxwell part, because let's say they had presented Havis in the district court and the judge doesn't address it at all.
Maxwell says as long as you give your 3553A reasons, you don't even have to. The law does not require courts to expressly rebut each argument.
That's still, that sounds a lot like ordinary review for ordinary sentencings, and there's a
sure,
lot of...
that's in the 3553 world, right? So you do present it, district court says nothing, it doesn't rebut it, it just says, look, you're a bad guy, as it did in Maxwell, so I'm going to leave you in jail, and I'm not going to consider the change to the career offender guideline. We say that's fine.
The judge didn't say that, though, right? In your scenario, the judge doesn't address it at all because he's not required to rebut every argument. Is that the
scenario? Yeah.
Okay. So I would say that there are cases from this circuit that would say that's a non-frivolous argument that the judge was required to address under ordinary review standards, even with that language that you quoted from Maxwell. I don't think that Maxwell says if you raise it, the court says nothing at all, and it's a non-frivolous argument, they still don't have to rebut it.
No, I agree with that. They have to address non-frivolous.
And I'm very sorry my time's out, but I do want to say one tiny thing.
Please, go ahead.
Which is that the guideline amendment that was went into effect in 2014, 782, I think is the number, that's called colloquially called drugs minus two. It applied to many drugs. It was made retroactive, but it's not an amendment that was specific to the Fair Sentencing Act. And yet this court says it applies retroactively in Johnson, in First Step Act proceedings. Other courts have said the same thing. So it's not entirely accurate that only the Fair Sentencing Act amendments apply when you're calculating the amended guideline range. Already this court has said other retroactive guideline amendments apply that are not Fair Sentencing Act specific. So I know that you say there's no debate about whether Haves applies retroactively, but there is actual precedent that says that a retroactive change that is not from the Fair Sentencing Act applies retroactively. So thank you very much.
Thank you for your good arguments and excellent briefing. It's a confusing case that we're struggling with, and we appreciate your work on helping us think of the things that need to be considered in resolving these cases.